May it please the court, my name is Robert Hill. I represent the plaintiff appellant, registration number 6873, and with me at council table is John Evans. This is one of 14 appeals taken in related cases involving identical claims, and all of which were summarily dismissed on summary judgment motion by the trial court on an identical rationale. The rationale was that insurers, read this, issuing multi-vehicle policies on a take-it-or-leave-it basis had no disclosure duty because, in the trial court's words, quote, there was no decision to be made by the insured post D. Herrera. There have been multiple panels addressing this issue, and all 12 opinions have been entered to date. 11 of those have reversed the grant of summary judgment. One has affirmed it. The affirmance was in Reynolds versus Allstate Indemnity. And I want to be very direct in acknowledging that I do not think there are distinguishing facts between the Reynolds opinion, the facts in the Reynolds case, excuse me, and the facts in this case. Because Reynolds was decided after all the briefing in this case, the court hasn't had any briefing on that and on how it applies or on what the issues are. 15 minutes isn't much time, but I'm going to use what 15 minutes available to me to try to suggest why I think this court's outcome should be different. The Reynolds court primarily based their decision on the absence of an affidavit in opposition to the summary judgment motion. The opinion references that, I think, at least 9 times, maybe more, depending on how you count the references. The simple fact is that the plaintiffs in each of the 12 cases, none of them did they submit affidavits. That was not viewed as a determinative factor by any of the other 11 panels, and I don't think it should have been in Reynolds, and I don't think it should be here today. But let me explain why, in this case in particular, we chose not to submit an affidavit. By the time the court filed our opposition to the summary judgment motion, in this case, the trial court had entered orders summarily dismissing 9 of the related cases. In each of those 9 orders, all of which have now been reversed by this court, the trial court ruled as a matter of law that an insurer using a multi-vehicle policy requiring an insured to purchase UIM on either an all-or-nothing basis had no disclosure duty. And that was based on the presumption or the statement that there was no decision to be made by the insured post D. Herrera. Thus, at the time we might have made a decision about filing an affidavit in this case, we had been told 9 times that the controlling issue essentially was the business practices of the defendant, nothing more and nothing less. Not surprisingly, Allstate's summary judgment motion was premised on exactly that point. The very first sentence in Allstate's motion sets it out. Consistent with the court's recent rulings in Travelers and USAA, Allstate, as a single election, single policy per household insurer, is entitled to summary judgment. It went on to say that the case was materially identical to Travelers and USAA. Both Travelers and USAA have been reversed. But that only begins to explain why we concluded that an affidavit would not be appropriate in front of the trial court. When we filed a Rule 56F motion seeking additional discovery before responding to the summary judgment motion, Allstate opposed the motion, arguing that discovery was unnecessary, based on the very same premise, that the issue should be determined on the basis of the defendant's business practices. The trial court's ruling denying our motion for time for additional discovery is particularly instructive because it really set the stage then for us to file our opposition. And I'd just like to quote what I think is the relevant portion. Quote, defendant Allstate Insurance Company filed a motion for summary judgment in which it claims Allstate follows the same business practices as the defendants in 2 related cases, Travelers and USAA. In those cases, the court granted motions for summary judgment based on the defendant's insurance company's business practices. Specifically, each issues a single policy to insure all household vehicles, and the insureds make a single election to purchase or reject UIM coverage for all household vehicles. Given that ruling in this case, as well as the gist of the motion, and given the ruling in the 9 other cases, There's no question to me as counsel that the trial court had told us there was no evidence, essentially, as to what the plaintiff would or wouldn't have done or anything like that, that would have been relevant in any fashion to her consideration of the summary judgment motion. She had indicated quite clearly in that ruling that it was going to turn on the business practices of the defendant. And when that order came down, summarily dismissing this case along with the other 13 cases, it was fully consistent. In fact, it attached and expressly incorporated the prior order in USAA and similarly ruled that in this case, insurers issuing multi-vehicle policies on an all-or-nothing basis had no disclosure duty. You can imagine.
Counsel, I'm sorry to interrupt. Did the policy here contain an OB&I exclusion?
No, it did not.
And isn't that a bit different than many of the other cases that you're referring to?
Yes, it is. But if you think about this, Your Honor, this is a non-disclosure case. What we were alleging, let me just jump back here for some notes.
I think you used the term illusory.
Excuse me?
Illusory, right?
I think there is that word in the complaint.
Okay.
The issues that we had alleged and that the trial court acknowledged we had alleged that should have been disclosed were that they had failed to disclose that the purchase of UM-UIM coverage on one vehicle provides UM-UIM coverage for all persons insured under the policy, regardless of the vehicle occupied. And number two, they had failed to disclose what, if any, benefit the insured received for the payment of the additional premium on the second vehicle.
Well, now, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, in some of the cases, we had alleged a third, which is that the OB&I was invalid. That was not in this case, as in some of the other cases.
Well, it was alleged in the third amended complaint here, but assuming that doesn't apply, was there any kind of an extra benefit in paying the higher premium?
There was an extra benefit if you classify it as what's called the class two. Arguably.
Okay.
That did not benefit the person doing the purchasing.
I understand.
And I think this was addressed maybe perhaps best in the Briggs opinion, which is a published opinion and also a companion case, where the court said, moreover, had Briggs been informed that the only benefit he received by paying UM-UIM premiums on multiple vehicles was that class two insurance received coverage, he could have made informed decisions about how to purchase the coverage he wanted. That was precisely what we were saying, is if they had told them, this is what you have without paying it, this is what you'll get by paying it, people could have made an informed decision. We're not suggesting in this case, it's not a case so much of, affirmative misrepresentation. It's a failure to disclose. So it's not an issue that we feel we should come forward and say, you said this and you're wrong. We say, you should have said these two things. And the Briggs opinion quite clearly endorsed and said that was appropriate in that context. I think this court should follow that. Neither of those disclosures was made in this case.
Can I ask you a question about Briggs? Isn't Briggs one of the cases where there was there were separate premiums for each vehicle?
Yes, there was.
That's not the case here?
Yes, there was.
So and that, give me your view on the importance of that factual distinction.
Isn't it ironic? In that case, where they are at least told you're going to be paying additional premiums for those vehicles, it was reversed, and they were held potentially liable. In rentals, the consumer had no way of even knowing, just as here, no way of knowing they were being charged that additional premium. It's not disclosed in any fashion on the materials that are given. So isn't it ironic that the 11 companies that disclosed something more, perhaps inadequate, but nonetheless something more, were held potentially liable, while in rentals, as in here, they were given no disclosure whatsoever. So if you purchased two vehicles, you had no way of knowing that you were paying 185% of what you would have been paying if you had purchased it for one vehicle. I mean, that's the case. The record's clear. You were paying 185%, but no consumer could tell that from any document they were given. The only way they could have told it is if they'd gone in and tested and had gone to one agent, said, I want to buy it for one car, gone over to the other agent, said, now I want to buy it for two cars, and then compared the two, and they would have discovered they were paying 185% for the multiple vehicle. That was not disclosed at all. And so to me, that difference stands non-disclosure on its head. We're punishing the company that discloses a little bit but not adequately, when the person keeps them totally in the blind, there's no liability. So I would argue it's just the opposite in terms of the impact in this case. I want to just briefly say that I think what we really have here is a situation where the Reynolds Court did not affirm based on the ruling of the trial court. They adopted essentially an alternative rationale, and I would like to just quote from this court, that is possible, as you know, in certain instances, but it, as this court said in O'Neill versus Wolpoff, that a similar situation when a trial court grants a defendant's motion for summary judgment but does not rule on one or more defenses asserted by defendant, a reviewing court may decline to consider those defenses. And I would suggest here, rather than, to be honest, I felt a little sucker punched. We'd been told by the trial court, we'd been told the fifth issue was going to be decided on the defendant's business practices, and then on appeal, we're told, oh no, we're not going to affirm on that, we're going to affirm because you didn't put in an affidavit, which the trial court quite clearly said was absolutely irrelevant, and which the law says is irrelevant. If you look at Briggs, Briggs says it's going to be an objective standard, and that's consistent with the law. It's done to protect the defendant from people saying we need more information because of our unique circumstances. Didn't matter what my plaintiff was going to do. The question was it material? If it was material, there was an improper non-disclosure. If it wasn't material, no matter what my client wanted to know, it wasn't a violation.
Am I correct that you did not appeal as a separate contention here the court's ruling on the 56F motion?
We did not appeal that. I would reserve the remaining time.
You have about 3 minutes and 16 seconds.
Every second counts. Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Peter Valletta. I'm here representing Allstate Insurance Company, the appellee, along with my co-counsel, John Vaught, who is counsel table. I'm appearing pro hoc vici, and I appreciate the court's permitting me to appear in this matter. As the Reynolds Court recognized, Allstate's forms and premium rate structures are unique from the other insurers in the other cases, and require a different result than the decisions in the other 11 cases aside from Reynolds. Counsel's acknowledged that Reynolds is identical factually to this case. And the rationale for Reynolds flows from some very simple facts. Allstate's policies always sold UM coverage that followed the person. It insured named insureds in any vehicle or other circumstance. Both before and after the D. Herrera decision. Allstate did not have an owned but not insured exclusion either before or after D. Herrera. And Allstate did not have a declarations page that tied any vehicle to a specific UM premium, but rather provided a UM premium on a policy basis. And that was true both before and after D. Herrera. The other decisions besides Reynolds reverse summary judgment because there were issues of fact about those circumstances. There were issues of fact about whether owned but not insured exclusions were in policies and whether they could have affected and misled or otherwise affected the decisions of policyholders. There were issues of fact about whether there were declarations pages listing UM coverage by premium by vehicle. Those facts don't appear in Allstate's policies, and as the Reynolds Court recognized, that left no disputed issue of fact to be determined because there were no failures to disclose, no omissions, and no misrepresentations in Allstate's policies. Because there were no such factual issues, the Reynolds Court determined that summary judgment was proper and affirmed, even though it didn't directly consider the specific ground that the trial court premised its argument on. Now, it should be recognized that in Reynolds and in this case, Allstate didn't merely rest upon the similarity of business practice that counsel has referred to as the reason why summary judgment was proper. Allstate totally asserted every one of these grounds before the trial court, as it has in this court, as grounds for judgment in favor of Allstate as a matter of law, because there are no disputed issues of fact. There is no disputed issue of fact that Allstate's policy contained the grant of coverage in line with D. Herrera, and that Allstate, in fact, did so before D. Herrera was even decided. So here we have the unique circumstance of a lawsuit has been brought against the company based upon a Supreme Court ruling that actually endorsed the practice that Allstate had been following for years prior to D. Herrera. And it's complaining that Allstate should have done something different after that decision was rendered, even though it didn't change how Allstate's policy was written, how the premiums were charged, or what rights and benefits the policyholders received as a result of that decision or its policy language. I find that extraordinary that Allstate is being attacked in this litigation for non-disclosure or misrepresentation when it got it right the whole time along. Regardless of the source of that duty, there was simply no misrepresentation and nor failure to disclose. As the Reynolds Court recognized, Allstate always told its policyholders that Class 1 insureds were insured everywhere. That Class 2 insureds received coverage in additional vehicles if you insured multiple vehicles under the same policy. And they were always told that the premium was a per policy premium, that the amount of the premium charged was based upon the existence of a coverage under the policy. Now, there were two different levels for that coverage. Allstate charged one price if you had a single vehicle. It charged a different price if you had multiple vehicles. And counsel says that the consumer is being punished because they're not being told the differential in that rate. But recall, in the very next sentence, he also told you the consumer had the ability to figure out whether or not he was being charged a different rate or higher rate for different coverages. He could go and test it in the marketplace. In other words, just as the Reynolds Court and the other courts, by the way, the other appellate decisions in this group of cases have recognized, Allstate was not obligated to go out and inform its policyholder about what was available in the marketplace from its competitors. Allstate was required to disclose accurately to its consumer, to its policyholder, what the coverage was, what they were receiving when they bought it, and what they were paying for it. And that's what Allstate did. Counsel talked at some length about the absence of an affidavit in this case, and how that should somehow not be a relevant issue for purposes of this appeal. In fact, as the Reynolds Court recognized, the failure by the plaintiff to come forward with appropriate factual information to rebut the unrebutted facts that Allstate's witnesses provided by affidavit was a failure on their part to show that there was relevant material evidence of an injury in fact and of damages which resulted from some breach of duty by Allstate. And that was their responsibility to come forward. And the mere fact that the trial court elected to couch its opinion based upon the business practice model issue that counsel described doesn't negate or avoid their obligation to come forward in the face of undisputed facts. Recall, while Allstate did argue to the court, yes, we should be affirmed, or we should be granted summary judgment just like you granted to the other insurers because we had the same business practice. We also argued, though, that we were entitled to it for all of the other reasons. The accuracy of our policy disclosures, the lack of a known but not insured exclusion, and the premium rate structure system, none of which created any issue of fact about the accuracy of all of the disclosures that Allstate made at all times to its policyholders. Excuse me. Therefore, Your Honors, the clear import of the issues that were presented to the Reynolds Court and that face you support affirmance of summary judgment for Allstate because there are no disputed issues of fact, and there is no basis from which you can determine that Allstate somehow made a misrepresentation or failed to disclose information, because the facts about those disclosures are all undisputed. The policy terms, which appear in the policy documents and explain what the benefits are, the premium rate structure, which is established by affidavit and explained at length as to why there is a different rate for different vehicles and the different risks that the company faces when it insures multiple vehicles. All of those facts are entirely undisputed in this case, and they are not opposed in any way by any affidavit. There is no affidavit that says, I was misled. Ms. Mullen did not come forward at any point and say, I was misled by anything Allstate did. So counsel is entirely left with coming forward and simply saying, all right, well, the form and substance of your documents and your practices have to provide me with the basis for my action, and they don't. As I said at the outset, Your Honors, I find it extraordinary that Allstate got it right before De Herrera, and after De Herrera is now subject to a lawsuit asserting that it did something wrong because it followed the same practices. There was no failure to disclose here. There was no inaccuracy in the disclosures. And we would argue and urge that the court affirm summary judgment as the court did in Reynolds on those grounds. Thank you.
The issue before the trial court and the issue in the summary judgment was not whether there was a breach of the duty, whether there was the existence of the duty, and that was the focus of that briefing. The trial court held that 609 was the sole, essentially, source of duty. Each and every one of the cases that have reversed have found that not to be the case. There are multiple sources of duty, as those have held. I'm reminded, I mean, what you heard was essentially just what I said. This was not affirmed in Reynolds on the basis of the trial court's ruling. It was affirmed on what I will call an alternative ground. There is a United States Supreme Court decision also addressing this with a very similar theme, the one I quoted from this court, which is Dandridge in the Supreme Court, which is 397 U.S. 471, footnote 6, where it says, when attention has been focused on other issues, or when the court from which a case comes has expressed no views on a controlling question, it may be appropriate to remand the case rather than deal with the merits of that question in this court. And that is what I would suggest Reynolds should have done after it had reversed on the grounds that the trial court had entered, and that's what I would ask this court to do. The mandate...
Can I stop you there for just
certainly.
A minute? If what we have are undisputed facts and it's purely a question of law, why would we remand it to the trial court? Why can't we do that? Why shouldn't we do that as an appellate court and rule on the legal issue?
Well, the issue that got ruled upon by the Reynolds Court, at least, was that we should have put what the plaintiff would have done in the event something had been disclosed that was not disclosed. And that is simply irrelevant in our view. And I suppose you could review on that. You could go to Briggs, and you could agree with Briggs and agree with the restatement second, and say that in a non-disclosure case, the test is whether or not the facts that were not disclosed should be viewed as material. And we were briefing and arguing based on that, both because of prior Colorado law and now because of the Briggs decision, which affirmatively holds that, and citing other Colorado, obviously, previous cases. So I think the court could do that and simply disagree with the Reynolds decision, because the standard clearly is an objective standard. What my client might or might not have done is irrelevant. The question is whether a jury might find that it was reasonable information, as Briggs found it to be reasonable information, and that's express finding in Briggs, a published opinion in a companion case. So you have, to me, an irrevocable sort of conflict between the ruling in Briggs and the ruling in Reynolds. And you could do one of two things. You could resolve that and either agree with one or the other as to whether it's an objective or subjective standard. It's clearly an objective standard based on Colorado law, I think, and based on Briggs. Or you could say that this should be briefed and fully argued when everyone knows that's the issue. In other words, of subjective, potentially, or objective. Either one. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, for your excellent arguments. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.